Sir David King, a highly distinguished chemistry professor, was chief scientific advisor to the British government during the Blair administration. During that time, he put climate change on the front burner in Britain and campaigned vigorously, as he's still doing, for the shift from a carbon-based economy to one driven by renewables and by nuclear energy in particular. He's in New Zealand next week, and I spoke to him on Friday. How does a chief scientific advisor rationalise the huge number of requests and obvious areas in which to focus attention? I mean, the scope is limitless. Is there a kind of protocol against which you would, with the agreement of the government, focus on this rather than that?
Well, I think the chief scientific advisor is very much on his or her own, because you're the person who's meant to be the expert. And so when I say on your own, nevertheless, I set up teams of people who would advise me. But then I would proceed accordingly. So looking at Britain, for example, and climate change, what we determined with a bunch of experts was that the big challenge for Britain as the planet warms up is from rising sea levels and changing rainfall patterns. And so we could see that flood risk was the greatest risk. And so we set up a big program, advised government. The net result of that program was that we became the first country in the world to have a climate adaptation policy being implemented. And the cost was upwards of £500 million to £1 billion a year to implement this. But we are probably saving, for every pound invested in that, we're probably saving £7 in flood damage in Britain. So it's a policy that is attractive to government for that very reason.
Do most of the solutions on very large issues, the bigger global challenges that we face now, increasingly lend themselves to science? In other words, science is clearly going to have to play a much more integral role in the decision making on issues like energy and climate change.
I believe that's exactly the right way to look at it. First of all, science needs to evaluate what the nature of the challenge is. And the nature of the challenge is going to be different in different parts of the world, not just different countries, but regions of countries. And we need to know what those challenges are and then set about adaptation to manage climate resilience. But on the other hand, we also need to step up the investment into alternative energy sources. I would go much further than that and say we need to step up investment into what is often called biomimicry, learn from nature about how to adapt ourselves to something in which waste is no longer a reality. Nature doesn't waste anything, it's recycled. And so the word recycling is now, of course, very often used, but I think we need to go much further. The phrase circular economy gets much closer to it. So everything, in the end, becomes reused, and energy itself then has to be energy which is originally derived from solar energy, but it could be in the form of wave energy, wind energy, whatever. But so that energy doesn't use up a resource such as oil, coal, and gas. So the minerals, for example, again, recycling minerals, we need to see that we move into a state where manufacturing is done in such a way that you manufacture an item, put it into the marketplace in such a way that it is designed to be recycled and recovered and put back into the marketplace. This is beginning to emerge, and I think this is going to give rise to quite possibly a period of tremendous scientific innovation, wealth creation, improvement in human well-being of a kind that we haven't seen for perhaps 50, 70 years.
This depends upon a rather delicate and often difficult relationship between the scientific community and the business world. I mean, these partnerships are really not that easy to run, are they?
Yes, that's again a very good point you raised there. There is a sense in which the business world welcomes what I've just said, but this would be the business community that is agile, that is able to move quickly. And one of the problems that we're faced with is inertia. If you're a business, for example, that manufactures cars, and you have invested very heavily into a car manufacturing plant, you're not going to adapt very easily to a completely alternative method of manufacturing a car. So, for example, the cars that are produced in the manufacturing industry today are all produced as an outcome, an evolution from the Model T Ford. So the chassis has an average of 1,500 bolts. There is one car manufacturer now producing a chassis that is made from fiber plastic, recovered from plastic bottles, no bolts in the chassis, and it's produced in about 40 seconds on the manufacturing plant floor. Completely revolutionizes the production of the car and takes on board the whole recycling phenomenon. Now, I think that there's where you may come into difficulty with business because of vested interests in existing business modes. But I think in time, I refer to the agile companies, it tends to be the small companies, will break the mold. And the word disruptive is often used for the technologies that break the mold. And I think it is the disruptive technologies that will rapidly come through. And the reason I believe that is because of the extraordinary rapid rise we've seen in commodity prices. So the commodity prices are now high enough that we incentivize these alternative modes of manufacturing to come through.
I want to come back to that in a moment. But a few years ago you suggested that there should be a kind of Hippocratic oath for scientists. Why did you say that at that stage? Was there a risk that was apparent to the integrity of the scientific community in certain circumstances?
Yes, I did put out a short 7-point form of the Hippocratic Oath for scientists, and I still believe it's a good idea for scientists to adopt this. The reason was, when I came into government in Britain, we had just had the BSE crisis, the food from cows that had conducted this, had been subjected to this this awful disease, and it turned out that this then opened the possibility for human beings to get variant CJD. Now, initially, the British government went out saying that their scientists had said it was perfectly safe to eat British beef. And it subsequently turned out that this was not the case. This gave rise to a lot of skepticism, particularly about whether or not the scientific advice being given in government was subject to policy and not determining policy. And I really had to pull back from that and try to regain the trust of the public in what the scientific community could do for them and for government. And in that process, it did seem to me that we needed to raise the level of trust that scientists have in the public domain much more generally. That was the origin of that attempt I made.
A decade or so, it looks as if the switch to a low-carbon economy was really beginning to bite. We were making great progress. Now people are not so sure. What is it in your mind that has blunted the effort and the achievement?
Well, let me first of all say that the British government, and I'm, of course, rather involved in having pushed this through, the British government, of whatever political hue, because we got all-party agreement to this, is committed to a low-carbon economy. We're committed by 2050 to have reduced our carbon dioxide emissions by 80%. And the only way we can do that, and this is also accepted, is that all of our energy production has to be defossilized by 2050. And so we have set in train carbon budgets, four yearly carbon budgets. They're already determined out to 2024. And the Climate Change Committee of Parliament is currently determining the 2028 budgets. And this country will follow those diminishing budgets with time. And what we will demonstrate, I'm absolutely sure of this, is that this not only can be done, but can be done with economic benefits to the country as well. So that's my first response. The British government hasn't swayed from that position at all. Around the world, I see differences depending on where you are. What has happened, strangely, since Copenhagen, because Copenhagen was deemed to have been a failure, the COP process, that we have seen almost a turnover of who is taking action on climate change. Countries like the rapidly emerging countries, China, India, Brazil, and so on, but also least developed countries, countries in Africa such as Ethiopia and Rwanda, are all taking on board policies which will lead them to low carbon emissions.
Isn't that a case, though, of them having some quite low-hanging fruit which they can grasp in the short term as against the Western world?
I'm talking about countries, 8 out of 20 of the fastest growing countries in the world last year and the year before were in Africa. So the two countries I've just mentioned have got GDP growth over the last decade or so of about 7 or 8%. Mm-hmm. These are rapidly growing economies, and what they have seen is that they can grow their economies rapidly and manage this defossilizing program to their own benefit. New Zealand imports an enormous amount of oil, and that is a big drain on your economy, and they've understood that particular message. And if you take that on board early on and start searching for alternative local forms of energy, you put local people to work, and you're saving on hard-earned dollars on the export-import market.
Yeah.
So I think these benefits, you can describe them as low-hanging fruit, but I would say they're also there for the developed world. But interestingly, of course, and I think this is principally because of the lobby system in the United States, the anti-action group is in the United States, is in Canada, was in Australia, and so it's a curiosity that the countries that back in the time of the beginning of the Kyoto Action are now those countries that are backing away from it.
Let's come back to the UK. You're a very strong supporter of the nuclear option for Britain, and you've been critical of the loss of momentum, not just on climate change, on this, but on climate change in general. The latest report from the Parliamentary Energy and Climate Change Committee, just come out, is interesting in the sense that it makes the case now for what are effectively subsidies to get this new quantum of nuclear generated energy up and running. How easy is that going to be?
So we have a system of subsidies for low carbon energy from renewables, whether it's wind or solar, and that is a true subsidy. And I think what you're referring to is guaranteed pricing for electricity.
Yeah.
To encourage the utilities to build nuclear power stations. The reason for this is simply that these companies are saying we've got 8 years of investment without return in building nuclear power stations, And then if we produce electricity for the next 50 years from those power stations, we want to be sure that there's a bottom line below which the price will not fall. Otherwise, the investment up front doesn't make sense.
Yeah, this is the contracts for difference system. Huh?
Yes. So I think that I favour this process. I think it's reasonably well-negotiated process. The most important thing for the British government is to recognise that, as with the point I've just been making about developing countries, just as with them, if we produce electricity from our own resources in the United Kingdom, then we save on imports and we manage our debt crisis rather better than we have been doing. So there's in addition to managing CO2 emissions and our targets, we also, I believe, will improve our economic growth.
How will you manage public resistance where it exists in the UK to the construction of new nuclear power plants?
The interesting thing about the British public is that we understood when I was back in government from 2003 onwards that if you ask the opinion of the British public, are you in favour of nuclear power stations, new nuclear power stations being built, the answer was roughly 60% against. But if you ask the question, in the light of our environmental challenge, are you in favour of nuclear power stations? The answer is yes to 60%.
Yes.
So it does depend on how you ask the question. And interestingly, there was a dip in British public opinion over nuclear new power stations after Fukushima. But today we're right back up, even more positive about nuclear new build than we were at that time. So the British public is happy that this is a good way forward. By the way, we know that we have to spend something like £200 billion over the next 10 years on new energy sources because we've got a very aging stock of coal-fired and gas-fired power stations. And it's all a matter of how wisely we spend that money.
That was Sir David King.